My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing.
Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and today I'm going to be conducting an interview with Stacy Brown, who is a listener of Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices, and who contacted me with interest in sharing her story. So, Stacy, thank you for contacting me, and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Yeah. And we also have listening in and might possibly answer questions at some point along the way. Her partner, Sunshine. Hello, Sunshine.
Hello.
Okay. So why don't we just go ahead and dive right in and use the same format I've been using for everything else. Can you tell me what life was like for you as a kid in relationship to the church and your experience being a Mormon as a kid?
Yeah. So I grew up in the church. I was born to parents that were both LDS and married in the temple in the covenant. But my experience was a little bit different because my parents were divorced when I was about five. And so it kind of created, and I get a lot of that question when I tell people, my parents were divorced. It's kind of like, Mormons can get divorced? And I always tell them, well, yes, divorce is fine. It's gay marriage that ruins families. Let's be clear.
Of course.
But, yes, my parents were divorced. And I had this sort of, it was kind of a big Mormon family splits and then becomes two more big Mormon families.
Okay.
And so both remarried and both had more kids. And so I grew up with, there was four of us, and then my mom had three more, so she had seven kids, and then my dad had five more.
Holy moly.
And then adding steps and halves and everything, I think I have about 14 siblings, I believe.
Wow. And did you guys all get along, and
yeah,
or was it stressful?
For the most part, I'm very close to several of my siblings. In fact, I have to give a shout out to Sarah, who listens to the podcast. But
hello, but yeah, Sarah.
We are, some were closer than others, obviously, with that
obviously.
Many.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of not really a family. It's like a big group.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
I grew up here in the Portland, Oregon area, in Vancouver, Washington.
Okay.
But my dad lived in Sandy in Salt Lake for most of my growing up. So.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you were in a really LDS area. I mean, there's lots
right.
of Mormons there, but it's not like Utah.
Right. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Which I think was a benefit.
Right. Definitely.
Most of my close friends were, in fact, like in high school, most of my close friends were not LDS.
Mm-hmm. And were you happy with the church as a kid?
You know, I think I was pretty normal. Like, I didn't love going to church, but I didn't hate it either. It was just sort of normal, like part of life, mm-hmm. and I accepted it as such.
Did you believe it?
Well, there was an experience I had that I think is important for my story when I was about, 14 or 15, after my first year of seminary. And that was when, that was the first time I'd ever read the Book of Mormon,
mm-hmm.
I think, like most people. And I was one of these that I just really had a profound experience with the Book of Mormon. I just loved it. I drudged through the first half of it, but once I got to like Alma, I really just loved it. I read it and read it and read it. And I remember going to the library at school during lunch, which for me is big because I'm really social.
Mm-hmm.
But I just couldn't put it down. It was like one of those books you just can't put down. And so I had this really profound experience with that. And then I remember after I'd read the Book of Mormon, in that summer, we have a family cabin in Eastern, in Island Park. Some of the listeners will know where that is. It's in Eastern Idaho. Mm-hmm. And I was at the cabin and I decided, okay, I'm going to do, you know, Moroni's promise, and prayed about the Book of Mormon and had a real, you know, testimony building result of that prayer. So I really felt like, okay, not really necessarily that the church is true. That wasn't really the response I had. It was more of the church is good.
Okay.
And that's kind of where that ended, you know, and so I think that describes a lot of my belief. I wasn't solid in my belief, and I wasn't, you know, and don't get me wrong, I wasn't really great at scripture reading and prayer when I was a kid. But I did have that experience, which sort of became a foundational experience for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Was it like a spiritual witness, like an emotional response you had to a prayer you prayed, or was it something more profound than that?
Yeah, it was. I'm sure it was very emotional based. I mean, mm-hmm. In retrospect now, at the time it felt very spiritual. And really, I mean, it kind of fit the semantics that, you know, Mormons would use about, I received that prompting or that voice, you know, okay. The still small voice. I mean, it kind of fit that, you know, pattern.
Okay. So. All right.
But it wasn't like I had a vision of God or anything. Right.
Okay. So it seems like you just didn't put a lot of thought into it as a kid, which I didn't either. So,
yeah.
So, but when you became a teenager, you had this experience.
Something I want to point out too. I kind of took some notes before.
Yeah, go for it.
And that's, you know, and I don't want to delve into my family situation too much, but I really feel like when I was growing up, my mom and my parents had a lot of guilt around the divorce issue. Mm-hmm. And they had been excommunicated, from the divorce and had to like meet with the general authorities and get, you know, their,
blessings restored
and rebaptism. And it was confusing for me, but you know, I was there through that whole thing. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I just think that's important for my story because I really feel like my mom was super devout. Well, my mom and stepdad, which was the family I primarily grew up in, they were really, really devout in the church. But I think a lot of that was that redemption they were looking for. If that makes sense.
From what they viewed as mistakes they had made in their past.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anyway, I just wanted to insert that.
Okay. But you felt that the way your mom lived, her LDS religion, that affected you growing up?
Yeah, totally. So there was sort of this expectation I felt, even if it wasn't really voiced by her, that we needed to follow the church because that was super important to her. So,
right.
So I was a, you know, Janis Cat Perry singing young woman.
Right. And do you think she felt that somewhere inside that if all of her children turned out okay, you know, if they all were devout, good Mormons, then maybe that would be the redemption from, you know, the mistakes in her past or whatever?
Totally, totally. Okay. In fact, I had a conversation because when she got divorced, I mean, it wasn't a picnic for her, right?
Right.
I mean, she was ostracized and by her ward, and her bishop was like, do not divorce under any circumstance. And, you know, she decided to go against the bishop's counsel, and which was huge for her. And I mean, there was just all this drama around that. And mm-hmm. One time I asked her, why would you put up with that? Why did you stay in the church? And her answer wasn't really from a place of because I believed it with my whole heart. It was more like, I believed it was best for you kids to raise you in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was sort of where, I don't know, that whole foundational upbringing came from.
Okay. So it was pretty influential in what you felt you needed to be doing when you were growing up.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. So it sounds like you had a pretty average LDS childhood and, mm-hmm. and you, good kid, got into high school, went to seminary, believed that the church was true. Right. Do you think there was anything else in your teenage years that, spiritually that had an effect on you, you know, in your story with the church?
Mm-hmm. Not really. I think that kind of summarizes it pretty well.
Okay. Can I ask you about when you started realizing that you had same-sex attraction?
I love that term.
Is there another one that's better? I'm sorry. I don't mean to.
No, it's great. I think that's fitting in the context of the story we're telling, right?
Okay.
At that time, I would have referred to it. Mm-hmm. No, I had no... When I was in high school and younger, I mean, in retrospect, you can always go, well, yeah, you know, I was kind of obsessed with that friend, you know, mm-hmm. or normal people don't think about this or that. But at the time, I was completely oblivious. Okay. I didn't know. I knew some gay kids in the high school, but they were like the waivers and the, you know, alternative kind of culture. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't identify with that at all. Or they were like the softball players that were really butchy. Mm-hmm. And I didn't identify with that either. So I just thought, well, to be a lesbian means being like that. And I'm not like that. So
you did maybe question it a little bit and decided you didn't, that neither of those roles were you?
I don't think I questioned it for myself at all. I just thought I was a late bloomer. I mean, I didn't date guys or desire to date guys. Most of my guy friends were gay.
Uh-huh.
I was in the choir, and I remember my mom coming in my room and, you know, isn't there any boy that you like?
Uh-huh.
I was like, not really, no.
Right, but so you figured
I'd find love in college, you know.
Right.
I just never really.
Okay, all right. So you went to Ricks.
I did go to Ricks.
And was there anything in between high school and Ricks?
No.
No, just went straight to Ricks.
Yeah, I started Ricks. I was still 17.
Oh, okay. Did you start like in the summer? Or did you start regular in the fall?
No, I started in the fall. I just have a late birthday.
Okay.
And so it just kind of worked out. I was really young.
Gotcha. Okay. So how was Ricks?
Ricks was kind of an interesting experience for me. The first semester, I think it was kind of a culture shock because I really, even though I'd visited my dad in Salt Lake before, or in Sandy, I just really hadn't lived in Mormon culture before, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of coming from, you know, my best friends are not LDS, and I go to church, but I don't think about it a lot during the week, to this environment that was like, I don't know, youth conference every day, right?
Right.
And, you know, and I had roommates that were kind of your typical Rick's roommates that, you know, were hoping to find a husband while they were there. And, you know, and I think my first semester I had a little trouble adjusting. I felt some loneliness, but, you know, kind of normal freshman. And mm-hmm. I dated guys a little bit there. I dated this 23-year-old. I remember that was so old.
So
but it was never like a serious thing, right?
Right.
And I think that was my thing. I mean, I can date guys, but I never could get past that sort of superficial stage
mm-hmm.
in the dating relationship. So it was really my second semester. So I went home for Christmas and came back. And I started this French class, and in the French class, I had this friend who was like a friend of my sister's. My sister and I were at Rick's together, and she was really crazy and outgoing, and she said, okay, this French is hard, so let's find the smartest people in the class and form a study group. And I thought, well, that sounded like a good idea because I wanted to get a good grade. And so anyway, one of the smartest students was, I don't know, Jane. I'll change the name to protect the innocent.
Okay.
And so we start hanging out in this study group, and suddenly the study group becomes like my core friends. When I was there for second semester, we just we did everything together, hung out all the time, had dinners together. And then I found that Jane and I started spending more and more time together. And it just got to the point I couldn't get enough time with her. You know, I would like stalk her around campus and try to run into her. And, you know, and I'm thinking this is just a beautiful blossoming best friendship, right? Because I'm super naive. I mean, nobody ever talked to me about, you know, I knew that homosexuality existed, but only in the context of this is a sin that is, you know, next to murder and right. unnatural, you know, like,
right.
So I didn't really associate what I was doing with that. And I think because partly is I thought it was a choice for people. And, you know, what I was doing with her, what seemed so fluid and natural, and, you know, it didn't really seem like I was making any sort of conscious decision to fall in love with this person. Right.
Right.
And so, yeah, we just started spending all of our time together in late, deep conversation and, you know, just couldn't get enough of each other. And then, the relationship evolved and, it did, I don't know what to call it, a kind of a, she became my girlfriend. It became a full on affair.
Okay.
And it kind of surprised me because I had not really thought about it. But again, it just seemed like I had this best friendship. And we didn't even define what we had as lesbian. We just felt like I was in love with the person.
Okay.
And, you know, gender inconsequential, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, but it still had such a, it was just like this impossible situation because we didn't really have anyone to talk to about it, but we knew if we did talk to someone about it, it would result in, you know, being dismissed from Rick's, right?
Right. Yeah. That's probably not something that you would just get a little slap on the hand for.
No. Okay. I mean, we would be expelled from school, right? Mm-hmm. And then separated.
Right.
And that was the thing we just didn't want, right? Because we were really into each other.
Right. Right. So, were you at that time struggling with the theological consequences of what of your relationship? Did you start to have, you know, I hate this term, but cognitive dissonance about that? Or did you just not even did you just not let the two meet? Like, did you never let yourself process it in that way?
Well, it was hard not to. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, we went to church every week. Well, we were in different wards because at Rick's, you know, there's so many wards there, but,
right.
But it was a little hard because I remember at the time I was involved with her while we were at Rick's, but then going to church on Sunday. And I remember feeling the spirit at church, or what I felt was the spirit. And I remember that not matching with what I had been taught, in that when you sin, you are no longer...
You no longer keep the company of the Holy Ghost.
Exactly. And so that didn't make sense to me. And in a way, it sort of fed this weird idea I was forming that somehow this relationship was sanctioned by God. You know, like he was making an exception for us.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
So I had this sort of weird fantasy that I was building in my mind with the, you know, because I was completely in love, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but I think, you know, I always tell people that are heteros that it's the same emotion.
Right.
It's the same giddiness. It's the same everything, right?
The same obsession and infatuation and
all of that.
Right.
So
right.
I'm here going through this. I mean, it's huge, right? But what was hard was
your first love.
Yeah. But I had no one. There was no, oh my gosh, roommates. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
You know? Right. You had to keep it to yourself.
Right. There. Yeah. It was completely. Yeah. And I think that was really damaging because it really isolated us. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we, anyway, long story short, and I think Jane was having some issues with depression, and I was blaming myself for that. You know, I thought she was unhappy because, you know, she was so depressed because of me and our relationship, and it was really unhealthy. And so we were in church 1 week, and they read that letter. I don't know if you know about that. And like, I mean, this is early 90s, right? So they read some letter from the first presidency. Anytime they're going to read a letter from the first presidency, you know, mm-hmm. trouble.
Was it the proclamation?
No, this was before that, but it was like a, you know, we want to, it was kind of pre-proclamation, and they were reminding everyone that, you know, of kind of what things are sins. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, they had mentioned that, you know, homosexuality is not okay by God. I wish I could remember the real wording in the letter, but they read this letter and it was very blunt. And we kind of looked at each other from, we were in church together that day, and we looked at each other and we just fooled around that morning, right? Uh-huh. So we kind of looked at each other like, oh crap. And so we decide that we're going to go and talk to the bishop. And this is at Rick's, right?
Oh no. Yeah.
So we make an appointment and we go in, and I remember I didn't want to talk to the bishop. I just could not see any good. But she was actually from Rexburg and I think grew up in more of that Mormon context, mm-hmm. and felt like, you know, we should talk to the bishop. So we went, made an appointment.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. You said that she was battling some depression. Was she under the operating under the idea that, you know, wickedness never was happiness and I'm committing these sins, and in order to get my life straight and be happy, I need to go confess this and straighten up? Was that her motivation for wanting to go to the bishop?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so sad. Okay.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it was sort of, yeah, a way to, and I wanted to support that. I mean, I believe those things too. Right.
Right.
But I just didn't have the chemical issues.
Right.
So we go to the bishop and he just did not even know. It was very awkward. He did not know what to do with us. I'm sure he had never come across that before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he says, well, I just feel like I need to tell you what I would tell anyone that was struggling with staying morally clean. You know, so he gave us some guidance that he would give anyone, like an engaged couple. And, you know, things like try not to be alone together and try to mm-hmm. do things in groups and, you know, and so how do you do that when we have this sort of, we're already really isolated, like no one even knows what's going on, you know?
Right.
So anyway, he gave us all these crazy suggestions about, you know, how to, try not to be as close, basically.
So he didn't, I'm kind of baffled. Did he like immediately start discipline processes, like contact the honor code office and?
No, not at all. And I was shocked by that. I thought he would.
Yeah.
Was he the one? I think he asked if we had had oral sex, which I thought was really strange. And so it was like, no, we haven't, which, you know, we were pretty vanilla, as they say. Mm-hmm. So somehow I had the feeling from him that if we had had oral sex,
that would have crossed, would cross the line.
For some reason, that was his line. I don't know.
So what happened after the meeting with the bishop?
Well, it was still pretty horrible. And of course we could only stay away from each other. I mean, we tried putting these boundaries on our relationship and it lasted maybe a week. I mean, and there was a lot of that, a lot of just like putting boundaries on ourselves and we just blow right through them. I mean, it was just crazy, you know?
Right.
And, so we, so yeah, we, obviously we could not And it was really horrible because my roommate, I mean, Jane would come over and we'd like snuggle. Mm-hmm. I can't believe some of the stuff we. But I think, too, we got away with a lot under people's noses because people at Ricks and BYU have sort of this bubble of innocence that they mm-hmm. don't see. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And so we used to, but I guess when something happened and my roommate, who was also my cousin, called her mother concerned about me and this girl, and then her mother called my mother, and then my stepdad called me, and they were threatening to call Student Life and get me sent out of school. I mean, it was just really horrible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and one thing I feel like I want to say to the listeners, I love the radio format. I think something I've been thinking about this story a lot, kind of knowing we were going to have this interview, and something, I had this aha moment about why it was so hard. Like, why couldn't I just be like, you know what? I'm in love. She's a girl. This doesn't work at Rick's. Let's go somewhere else and be together, you know? Mm-hmm. But I really think there's something about having these shared standards that bond families close together. And I had this like mega size family, right? Mm-hmm. And what we share were these, the gospel and the bonds of the gospel. And so for me, it was sort of a thinking about, you know, my choices were, you know, to be with her, but only her. And I would lose everything else and all of this, you know, the family and this whole, all these experiences I'd had as a teenager, you know, having answered to prayer and feeling the Spirit, you know, it was impossible. Mm-hmm. It was an impossible situation for me. And so at this point, after we talked to the bishop and we obviously could not keep our boundaries, I came back home to Portland, but to get some perspective. I left school middle of the year and came home. Mm-hmm. And worked. And, but it was horrible. Like, I missed her, and we wrote long letters to each other every day and called as much as we could. I mean, it was just, you know, I was really broody and mm-hmm. moody and didn't get along with my family and couldn't really talk to them about what was going on with me, even though my mom kind of knew, but she didn't really want to talk about it. It was more of, just to be clear, in our family, we observe the law of chastity, you know. Uh-huh. That's really important.
Right.
And so I just, so it was very clear to me where she stood on this issue, and it really kind of closed that conversation with her. I didn't really even want to have it.
Okay. So had you at that point accepted that you were not straight?
No.
You just thought it was this one girl.
Yes. I thought,
okay,
this is just the person that I love.
And if you could get away from her and get over her, then you could be straight.
I could. Yes. And what was really horrible, Heather, is like when we were together with this girl, we were both like dating guys. We had like beards, they call it, you know, that term.
Yeah.
We totally did. There was this guy, I totally used him. I kind of feel bad now, but not mm-hmm. really. So I lasted about a semester, and then I just couldn't live without her. I just thought I'm just going to go back, and we're going to go back to that sort of secret life. And so she and I went to BYU together, you know, because mm-hmm. if you can't make Rick's work.
Out of the frying pan into the fire, right?
Why not go to BYU? Right. Yeah. I'm getting laughed at. So we go to BYU, and now we're roommates at Rick's. She lived with her parents, and then we kind of ran around, but at BYU, we were roommates and in the same room, and it was just bliss. Mm-hmm. Except we, you know, we still had this kind of crazy relationship, and we'd still go to church on Sunday, and we'd go to, you know, we'd get involved in the ward, and we'd go to ward prayer. If you went to BYU, you went to ward prayer. And we just kind of had this life we sort of built together, but it was still very secret and we were still very isolated. And I think that really, you know, was very unhealthy. And it really caused our relationship that could have been really a beautiful relationship. It caused it to be really unhealthy. I mean, we were dating guys while we were together. Mm-hmm. And this was all that jealousy and, you know, like she'd go on a date and come home and crawl in bed with me, you know, in my little twin bed. And, you know, I mean, we'd go to firesides together and we like, you know, kind of try to hold hands and not let anyone see, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just, it was crazy. And, but somehow, I don't know, no one knew. I almost wish we would have been found out. You know, there were times I just, it was hard to keep that secret.
It would have been easier to live in the open.
Well, I can say that now, but I wasn't ready and she wasn't either. I mean, we'd go through phases where I'd say, are you ready? Should we, you know, but we weren't even calling ourselves lesbians. We were just like, oh, I know we had like this weird terminology we kind of made up for everything, you know, the affection that we had and, you know, closeness that we felt like we would call it closeness.
Right. You know,
we didn't call it a relationship. It was only later that it was sort of like, well, duh, yeah. So basically, we had this real crazy thing, and when we got all the way through BYU together,
like this. Being roommates, same room, all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For three or 4 years.
I think 2 years.
2 years. Okay.
2 years. And by the end, she was graduating from BYU, and you know, because what does any like good BYU lesbian do? She goes on a mission, right? So I put in my mission papers and part of that, I was thinking, that I really wanted to get, like, it was just so unhealthy and something had to change, you know, just the jealousy and the secret, you know, secretive nature of our relationship and just something had to give. So I thought a mission just seemed like a great idea. But also I think I sort of had that, I don't know, that Janis Kat Perry, the, you know, if it's so be that ye should labor all your days. I sort of felt like if I can bring people to the gospel, that might make up for this horrible person I've been for the last, you know, 3 years or 4 years or however long. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that will be the thing that can really, you know, bring me back to the church and keep me bonded, I guess, with my family. But going on a mission, especially after I'd had this like relationship, it wasn't like I sinned one time.
Right.
We had a relationship, you know,
a long one.
Yeah. We could have been in Wymount Terrace or whatever the married house scene was. And so there wasn't really like, I couldn't just confess. Right. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like, what do you say? Right. And when you go on a mission, they don't fool around, right, in these interviews.
Right.
They want to know. And they kind of get into the, we know that, you know, you're taught that if you confess, your sins will be forgotten. But since you're going on a mission, we kind of need to know everything that you've done. I mean, these are the kind of questions I was getting.
Wait, so they expect you to confess to things that you had repented for in the past?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
They really wanted to make sure you were, you know, worthy. Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately I did all my missionary interviewing at BYU and I didn't have any sort of relationship with my bishop or stake president. I didn't know them. They didn't know me.
Right.
I think it would have been harder if I would have done it like in my home ward.
Right.
But I lied. They would ask me a lot about the morally clean. And, you know, I might have averted the question or lies of omission.
Right.
It's like, no, I've never done that with a man.
Right. That's what I was just going to ask.
Yeah. And so I just lied. I just flat out lied. And I think, to be honest, I felt worse about that, about the lying, than I did about the thing.
Right.
You know, because I had this sort of weird belief that it was sanctioned, you know, by God, our relationship. But how could I explain that to them? They're not going to understand that.
Right. So at that point, you still hadn't come to a point where you were, because it's the stories that I've heard are really tragic stories of people who just wrestle with, like, I'm a horrible person. There's mm-hmm. something evil in me that I can't change and God hates me, you know, but you never, were you able to escape from that unscathed or?
Not really, but I guess, like I said, I wasn't really going through the, am I gay? Am mm-hmm. I not gay? That came later for me.
Okay.
I was just like madly in love with this woman.
Right.
You know, and for me, I wasn't really ready to ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I did think I was a horrible person because obviously there was something wrong with me, you know. But I don't know. It was just sort of a...
Well, you know, the brain is really good at protecting itself. So yeah. You'd obviously built up some systems to not have to deal with that. So did
yeah,
you...
I guess so.
Did you end up going on a mission?
I did.
Where did you go?
I went to Italy, to the Padova mission.
Ugh, you and Greg Rockwell. I know. So jealous.
I noticed there's a lot of Italian missionaries on the site.
Are there?
Yeah. Maybe that's because, like, it's really the ideal mission for questioning people or people that aren't really, like, super charged about, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, being called to serve. Because, you know, with Italy, there's not a lot of like teaching the gospel. there's not a lot of interest in that
right.
country. And so you do other things, right? And
right.
so I really loved my mission. I spent a lot of time with old ladies talking about the war and, you know, mm-hmm. I really, and everyone will ask, so I'll address that. No, nothing happened with one of my companions.
Mm-hmm.
I did have one companion that we were like, extra close.
Mm-hmm.
But she was from Switzerland. So in their culture, it's kind of normal.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no issue, you know?
Right.
I wasn't invading any comfort zones or anything, but,
right.
You know, I had a good mission. You know, it was, and I was pretty good at being a missionary too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. So somehow I thought, well, this is it, you know, this is the Lord really, you know, resolving this issue for me.
Okay. And, yeah. Okay. So let's step back just a little bit and talk about my favorite, my like pet question. How was the temple the first time?
Ah, yes. I've heard you ask that. you know, for me, and understand, I had lied my way to the temple
mm-hmm.
completely. I was not worthy to have a temple recommend.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so fixated on my worthiness and my guilt that the whole ceremony thing didn't really faze me too much. Also, my mom was pretty open with me about what to expect because she didn't want me to be weirded out.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of prepared for the weirdness
okay.
of it. But it was weird, but I really, what I liked when I went through it, like when you do the initiatories, they tell you that, your sins are forgiven you.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that was a great sense of comfort for me because I had so much guilt and I thought maybe I'm going to be okay, you know, at mm-hmm. that moment. And so I didn't love the temple, but it was okay. I did, you know, it was just more of that guilt, like, oh my gosh, everybody knows I'm lying. And they make such a big deal about it. Like, if you're not worthy, stand up, you know?
Right.
Like anyone's going to do that. But like there's a point in the endowment where they want you to do that.
And as if there wasn't so much social pressure on you at that moment that you would actually do it.
Yeah, I've never heard of that happening, but if somebody should have, it was me because I wasn't, you know, worthy in that sense to be there. But yeah, so that was kind of my temple experience.
Okay. So while you were on your mission, did you go through the typical breakup emotions?
Yes. It was horrible. When I was in the MTC, no less, Jane, dear Jane to me. Mm-hmm. And she was kind of on her own journey out of this relationship, you know.
Yeah.
And with the church and things like that. And so really we were sort of on these parallel paths. We just decided to take them separately. And so right after BYU, she had graduated from BYU and she met some guy and got engaged. And so, of course, in the MTC, I'm just like in agony, you know, and just all those breakup feelings.
So she didn't go on a mission.
She did not go on a mission, but she didn't marry that guy either.
Okay.
Thank goodness. But I liken it to, here's my analogy for the pain of that, that I just put some Band-Aids on my bullet holes, you know.
Yeah. That's a very good description, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, but really we hadn't completely broken up because we wrote each other every week. I wrote my mom and I wrote her every week, you know? So, and sometimes I would sneak in a little apostate phone call to her, you know,
right.
And if I thought I could get away with it. So, you know, the real breakup came later and I can get into that. At that junction.
Okay. So was being in Italy on a mission kind of, was that just the Band-Aids on the bullet holes, or did you kind of get over it and develop some happiness and get into the mission? How did that go?
That's a good question. I think, I don't know if I'd say I developed happiness, but I had some really good experiences on my mission, and I really can't deny that. You know, okay. I can't sit here and tell you, oh, you know, I didn't believe it or didn't, I questioned it or,
okay.
And I love learning Italian. And in fact, in my professional job, I still work with languages even today. So,
okay. Yeah. And, so you're, as far as your spiritual life at that time, you were still believing and you thought that you were getting over this situation you had been in, and
right.
Okay. All right.
I guess I was hoping for that.
Right. Okay.
I you know, let's just say I was believing, but I wasn't compliant always. Mm-hmm. And the mission was really hard because they had all these rules, and I'm not a great rule follower. And so I had two mission presidents, which is really common because they switch every 3 years. And my first one and I did not get along. And so I think there was, and I will say the mission was the single most sexist experience I've ever had.
Oh, yeah. you did write me about that. So how was it sexist?
Oh, just the, you know, just if you observe the way the elders and sisters were treated, you know, they had this whole, in the mission, there's like a whole organization, right? There's like the office elders and the zone leaders and the district leaders and, you know, the senior companions, the junior companions. But then as sisters, we were sort of outside of that structure, which didn't really make sense because we were still accountable to it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And there was times like we do our little door-to-door tracting. And I remember we met this guy who wanted to learn the gospel. So my companion and I decided we'd teach him. Well, the mission president found out and told us we could not teach him because he was male. We were there to teach the women.
Right. You had to refer somebody.
We had to refer him to the elders. And that was a little frustrating.
Yeah.
Like I never had any experience like that before. And just little things like finding out the office elders came to our town and spent all day doing splits with the elders and working with them. And they didn't even tell us they were there. Mm-hmm. Like it was so weird, you know, like,
right.
It was a little hard and I had good experiences, but I wouldn't really call it testimony strengthening, if that makes sense.
Right. Okay.
Necessarily.
Right.
But I did have some, you know, again, some of those spiritual moments where I had promptings, you know, and I think that's a theme that I want to emphasize here, because I had something going on and it was just enough to keep me in, if that makes sense.
Right, right. You were having the experience you'd been taught you were supposed to have, and you didn't challenge it.
Right. Okay. Exactly. It was enough to kind of like, it spoke to me, like, you know, I still love the Book of Mormon. I still would feel answer to prayer, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, in these kind of things.
All right. So what happened? Your mission came to a close. You came home.
Yes.
And then what happened?
This was probably the most painful part, because I came home and so Jane didn't marry the first guy. But I came home and she was engaged to another guy. And so I came home and I supported her in that decision. And I went to their temple marriage. Can you imagine?
Oh, no. That's awful. So sorry.
They're in the ceiling room. It was horrible. It was, I can't believe I did it. Mm-hmm. I should just not gone. So she got married and got established in another state, and I went back to BYU and finished school. I had a semester left, mm-hmm. and then I moved down to San Diego, and so I had the sort of phase, San Diego phase in my life. That was right after my mission, and that was kind of the phase in my life I think I was looking more for that redemption from what I had learned about the church. So my ex, she got married, but the marriage only lasted about 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then she came out to see me in San Diego, and she basically just said, look, I'm a lesbian and I can't be married to him. I mean, it's just, my relationship with him is just not even in the same universe as what you and I had. Mm-hmm. I just can't do it. And so I, you know, and I'm just a few months home from my mission. I just couldn't even hear that at that time, you know?
Right.
I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, my brain is kind of going, well, am I ready to kind of come out and be that lesbian? And I just couldn't do it. And so I just had to end it with her, and it was really painful. What was really, really hard about that period is I didn't talk to a soul about it. So here I'd had this relationship, I mean, it's 5+ years.
Yeah.
You know, we built this kind of life together and, you know, it ended. Here was another huge bullet hole that I put a Band-Aid on, right?
Right.
I didn't do a soul. I just felt like, what am I going to say? You know, and I didn't talk to my family. And I remember at the same time I had this cat that got killed by a coyote or something. Mm-hmm. And I remember my sister thinking, telling me she thought I was like unusually grieving over this cat.
Right. Well,
yeah.
So I have a quick question. You had gone home from Rick's to try to resolve the situation. Yeah. And then you ended up going to BYU with her and being her roommate in the same room. Did your mom like freak out about that, or did she know what was going on?
I think, you know, they weren't really crazy about me being with her, like as a roommate, but she didn't really say anything. Like, we didn't really talk about it. At the same time, I had this younger sister who was really rebelling, you know, like she was drinking and getting arrested. And I think my mom was really fixated on her.
So it flew under the radar.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't know. That might be kind of a good thing. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to not have anybody to talk to about being in a relationship and experiencing all those things, you know, and then on top of that, have all of the extra, you know, anxiety and stress with your family. At least you didn't have to go through that.
That's a good point.
To some extent.
Right. That's a good point. And my mom, you know, after my mission, I mean, going on the mission and that whole thing, I mean, she was just thrilled. And I think she was thrilled that I was at BYU too. Mm-hmm. I think she just kind of felt like I'm going to be okay, you know?
Right. Okay. So going back to San Diego, mm-hmm. you broke up with her and yet again, you had to process all of that on your own.
Right.
And that's obviously not a healthy thing to have to go through.
You think?
Okay. So what happened after that?
Well, that was sort of my period. Like I said, I was really looking for that redemption and I got really devout in church. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is, I should say I got devout, but I don't think I ever really, I think I, because of this unhealthiness and all this experience, I sort of became numb, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think like emotionally numb to everything. And so I kind of describe it as I was very neck up in my approach to church. Like I was really devout. Like I was there every Sunday, but I wasn't feeling it.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Right.
And, but there was, I just had this redemption. Like I have been this horrible person and that is not the life I want. And I was not raised to be a lesbian and, you know, I'm just gonna try to be as good of a person as I can to make up for it. And, you know, that included being really devout. And I remember I went to something that was kind of profound for me at the time. I went to this, must have been a Relief Society broadcast meeting, because I remember it was Chaiko Okasaki. Remember her?
Mm-hmm.
She was speaking, and I remember the talk was about choosing life. And that was at that point really profound for me because I thought, well, I can do that. I'm going to choose eternal life, you know? So I'm thinking it's still a choice at this point. And I remember just singing, I know that my Redeemer lives at that fireside and just weeping mm-hmm. because I just wanted so bad to believe and have a savior that just could take all of this away. You know, I mean, just this heavy guilt and burden I was feeling. And so I just, you know, just wanted to just believe that there was a, you know, a Christ that died for our sins and just really get to know Jesus and the atonement and understand that. And so this was my time in my life. I tried to do that.
And so was this the time that you went through that, like, I'm evil, I can't get over my, you know, attractions, I can't master myself, why won't God, like, relieve me of these attractions and mm-hmm. let me be, you know, quote, normal? Was that the period when you were starting to battle all of that?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that is. Yeah, and I tried dating guys during this period of time. I was really thinking I was going to, you know, get married. I was going to the singles ward. And yes, this was the period of time where I was really trying to say I might be gay, but I don't want to be gay. Mm-hmm. The am I or am I not time. And I think I'm a little stunted because I think normal people go through that, you know, after their first like homosexual experience or thought. But no, it took me like a full relationship before I started going, maybe I'm gay. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm gay. But then I went to this fireside and I thought, well, it doesn't matter if I am or if I'm not. I can still choose to live the way I want to live, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. That was kind of my whole approach while I lived there. But, you know, things started kind of going south for me. You know, while I'm going through this, I'm building up my career. I have a lot of things going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I did talk to a bishop in San Diego. And this will be interesting to you, too. So I go to this bishop. And I, at the time, I was Relief Society president in this singles branch, right?
Yeah.
And but I just couldn't live with the guilt anymore. And the guilt was more from the lying, like I said.
Right.
And I thought, I'm just going to do it. And I bet they're going to excommunicate me. I don't know what's going to happen, but I just got to get this off my chest. And so I go and talk to the bishop. And in San Diego, this bishop, it was not the first time he had someone from the singles ward talk to him about this issue.
Right.
And then it sort of made me think, gosh, these singles wards are really hotbeds for people like me. But that's okay. And he like gave me a book to read, gave me a pat on the back and said, you know, and I guess I went to him with a little more contrite spirit. And so at the end of it, I just felt like it was sort of a pat on the head that you're going to be fine. And that was it.
And there was no, he didn't say, okay, well, in order to repent, you have to do X, Y, and Z.
Nope. He's like, I think you're fine. I said, well, don't you want to release me from being Relief Society president? I don't see why I should. And I'm thinking, well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But in a way, I think it, I don't know, it sort of just fed that.
It prolonged the experience.
Exactly.
Okay. So
the other thing to know when I lived in San Diego is it was during the Prop 22 debacle. So this was the precursor to Prop 8, right? And so that was on the ballot. And so I'm going to a singles ward and they're talking, you know, they're getting together and campaigning for this thing and putting, you know, they wanted us all to put signs in our yards. And I mean, there was a lot of dissonance going on when I was there. I was like, I can't do that. You know, I knew for myself. And then I had other friends that were gay and I just felt like, this is crazy that they're asking us to do this. And it was really awkward and really painful. And so, and I kind of regret that I didn't take a stronger stance and say, no, I'm against this. But I just sort of took myself out of it. Like I didn't even vote on that issue. I just didn't vote, you know? And I just didn't want to think about it, you know?
Okay.
So anyway, so things started going south at work. Oh, and I dated this guy in San Diego too. And so I'm thinking, okay, now I can, you know, get married. But this is an important story too. So I go to the temple and I was going to the temple like once a month when I lived down there. And I go to the temple and I'm like, okay, I'm going to pray if I should marry this guy. And I pray and I felt this response to that prayer of I thought of this other friend I had from that I grew up with, and I thought, well, if I'm supposed to marry this guy, I'm not going to be thinking about this other guy, so that must be my answer, right? So no, I'm not marrying him. And what's interesting, later that guy that I thought about in the temple, he actually is gay. So I thought maybe that was sort of meaningful in some way. Spiritual way, you know?
Right. Your brain was sending you a message, or the fates, or somebody.
Yes. I really, there had to be something to that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I moved back to Portland when things kind of started going bad in San Diego. And I kind of always knew I wasn't going to be there forever. And moved back here to be closer to family and just kind of get established. And I wasn't as heavily going to church when I first moved up here. Just, I don't know. I just thought I'd take a little break from it, but I was casual. I was a casual church goer. And, and right before I came back up here, I had the opportunity to meet Jane, my ex, for lunch. And that kind of messed me up because I met her and it brought up all these issues for me again. You know, I was able to put a lot of that sort of bury it deep. And so I moved back up here with sort of those issues floating around in my head that, okay, well, am I or am I not, you know?
Right.
And anyway, so I'm casually going to church, and in the singles ward up here, I meet another girl. And then I'm like, okay, I definitely am gay. Yeah, lightning doesn't strike twice.
Right.
I meet another girl, and, you know, it was very similar. So you're like, we spend a lot of time together. But yet we meet at church, and, you know, that's why I'm never gonna, no more Mormons for me.
So you thought the solution was to just stop going to a singles ward, or?
So at this point I'm like, I'm definitely gay. And I got a therapist because I'm thinking, well, you know, now I've identified the problem. I can work on the solution, right?
You want to repair it?
Yes. And I find this nice LDS therapist. But fortunately for me, this LDS therapist did not see that I needed repaired. She was more liberal and more accepting, and I was very fortunate. I've actually been really fortunate in the people I've come across in church, you know, in this way. Mm-hmm. So I'm in therapy for like a year, and meanwhile, I have this, again, another sort of unhealthy Mormon-y relationship, and this woman, we'll call her, I don't know, Mary, she could not accept being gay for herself. That just wasn't something she could or would ever be able to do. And I'm going to therapy and I'm starting to accept it, you know, and it's feeling really good to accept it and not fight it anymore. I think that that's sort of, that was like a huge time for me because I really, you know, just that moment of saying, you know, I'm gay and it's okay. It's okay. And God loves me anyway, and he made me this way, and I didn't choose it. You know, these are huge steps for someone.
Right.
And so she couldn't go there, and so she moved out of the country. So here I am in Portland, Oregon, which is like the lesbian Mecca. But, you know, I'm still sort of casually going to church. I'm still not ready to really break that bond I had with my family. Mm-hmm. And in, you know, my family is this big mega family. I mean, 95% of the family is very devout at church. Although I probably 30% of the family has read the Book of Mormon.
Right.
Really, I think that's just,
that's typical.
Really understands the religion.
Yeah.
But yet, God forbid you stop believing it, you know.
Of course. And so were you starting to disbelieve it?
Yeah, I was starting to have a lot of doubts. And what I did is I got on this website, and I think there's people on this site that look, were there too. It was called a Mormon lesbian website. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading these stories about people who were married with like five kids and lesbian and, you know, didn't know how to leave their husband or, you know, or had secret affairs. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, my situation could be way worse.
Right.
If I was to continue down the path that I thought I should be on, that is where it would take me. And I also at the same time made a really good friend at my work who is a lesbian. And I started talking to her about my situation, and she just tells me, you need to make friends. I think, you know, the Mormon lesbian site started really helping me work through these church issues. And I started doubting in the sense that, you know, the church has been wrong about other things in the past, including things that have touched my family, like divorce. So to me, it was like the cost-benefit analysis. The cost of me staying in the church and staying celibate with the risk of possibly one day a revelation to come to say, you know, we have decided that, you know, homosexuality is okay or something.
Wow.
And then here I've spent this like miserable life.
You know what? I had never even considered that before. I mean, I see obviously a lot of problems with what the church expects of gay people, but you're right. Can you imagine having sacrificed your entire life only to have the church come back and say, our bad?
Right. And it was like that bishop at Rick's who just gave us the same counsel he would a hetero couple. And a lot of church leaders will say that, you know, you have the same standard and the same expectations as anybody else. Live the law of chastity. But do you really like think that through? Like live the law of chastity forever? That's like a different statement than you know, just get through the next, you know, two-week engagement until you're married.
Well, and it's...
You can do whatever you want.
Right. And it's not just sexual celibacy. Like, I don't want to get into my story, but I understand what it's like to be truly alone in the world.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I spent a number of years alone.
Yeah.
And so I understand the isolation and what it does to somebody psychologically.
Right.
And to tell people you have the same standards as everybody else is absolutely, it's a farce. Because what they're expecting of gay people is that they live completely isolated. They're not allowed to have crushes. They're not allowed to go on dates. They're not allowed to have all of the other psychologically beneficial things of a relationship, like emotional intimacy and support and a family and all of those things.
I used to kind of wonder, so if what they say is true and they're fine, you know, as long as you're living the law of chastity, then I should be able to sit in sacrament meeting with my, you know, with holding my girlfriend's hand and my arm around her, just like an engaged couple would be.
Right. You know, you should be able to draw all over her back and do all of those things.
The little neck thing. You know? Yeah. You've been in singles wards, I think.
Yeah. So your faith fell apart just based on knowing who you were and what the church said about who you were, rather than like finding out about peepstones.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. That came later when I started listening to Mormon Expression.
Okay.
I mean, you know, the reality is I've known a lot of those things, like Joseph Smith's polygamy and things like that. I've always been kind of a history buff, but I guess they didn't bother me for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I think it was that, again, it's not logical, but I think it explains why people stay in the church when you're like, I don't understand. How could they stay? There's no logical reason to be a part of this church. But it's that shared standards, and it's so strong that it's hard to let that go.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I don't drink coffee and you don't drink coffee, we have something in common,
right?
You know? We can build on that. We can have like a really, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I just think there's a lot of things in my testimony, in my church life, in my, you know, especially when I was dealing with these issues and trying to find that redemption with church and also with Christ. I don't know. I feel like it wasn't going to happen. You know, like there wasn't logic to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just let things go because I thought, well, who am I to say? Joseph Smith had many wives. Well, I slept with a woman. So, who am I?
Right.
But really, what really changed my life in terms of the church was, so I have therapy. I was on this Mormon lesbian group. I was kind of accepting myself more and more and more every day. And I decided to talk to my bishop in my ward. And at this time, I'd been going to the family ward for like 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I'm going to talk to him. And I'm just going to, and this time, I'm not going in with a broken heart and a contrite spirit. I'm just going in with, I don't know what to do. You know, like legitimately, like I'm a lesbian. I don't know what to do about it. And so I go and talk to him. And this bishop was the most incredible man. I wish he could be everyone's bishop, because he just looks at me in that moment. And he said, "You must be so lonely." And I was like, yeah. And here I am in my 30s, you know?
Yeah.
He said, "You must be so lonely. You need to talk to your family about your struggles, like now. Your family should be there to support you, and you should not go through this alone." And I was like, oh. And he also said, I said, "Well, can I have relationships? What can I do?" And he says, "I don't see anything wrong with you having relationships. You know, he was really just like, you can't help it. This is who you are. Mm-hmm. And I just was so unexpected. And I just needed someone, an authority figure in the church, to give me that permission, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It was sort of like, instead of redemption through repentance, it was more like redemption through letting go of the guilt, just letting it go. Like, I didn't do anything wrong. Right. You know, and that was the true freedom from that. It was like, oh, you mean I'm okay. And so after that, I decided to come out to my family. And it was hard. You know, I wrote my mom a letter, and by now I've talked, my siblings all know. And of course our, I don't know what it is. It's like the younger generation doesn't have a problem with it, but it's like, you know, our parents and their parents that are a little bit hard to reach.
Right.
So I talked to my mom, and now my mom and I had had conversations before, but it was sort of like this, like, I wonder if I might be gay. And my mom's saying, well, maybe you are, maybe you're not. Either way, you need to stay in the church, you know, and live the church's standards. Mm-hmm. So here I'm coming to her and saying, okay, I am gay and I cannot live that standard. I cannot live like that my whole life.
How did she take that?
Well, she wasn't thrilled, but she accepted it. And at the end, she just said, well, I will follow the church leaders no matter what. So she made that clear to me. That was, you know, her priority was what the church would teach, not what I would say. But she was kind of open to hearing my struggles and willing to help, you know, where she could. My stepdad was horrible. Mm-hmm. He was the one who was like, well, we're all going to be in the celestial kingdom together and you're not going to be there. And I'm not sure I want you around the grandkids because I don't want you, you know, showing them something that isn't acceptable, you know, mm-hmm. like I don't want you being a bad example. Mm-hmm. Grandkids. Well, fortunately, I said, you know, that's not really your decision. The grandkids all have parents of their own and I'll respect whatever their parents say.
Right.
And of course, none of their parents have had an issue with me being around the kids or being with my partner around the kids.
That's you good.
Know? Yeah. So he kind of lashed out at me, but then he hasn't really acted. In fact, he and my partner get along really well. So
that's
good. Go figure.
So they didn't do any of that. We love you and you're always welcome here, but nobody else. Like you can't bring anybody home.
They just didn't want to see that any like romantic or homosexual behavior. That was what they said.
So you can bring your partners home. Just keep your hands to yourself.
We can't, you know, make out and have a lovemaking session at the family gathering. that was a line that we agreed not to cross.
How about holding, like if you had held hands sitting on the couch, would that have just caused lots of tension in the house?
Well, my mom did say that we asked her those specific things. Fortunately, my sister was there and she's like a debate person and knows how to communicate really well. And so she was like asking my mom really pointed things like, how would you feel if, you know, they held hands? And she wouldn't be really comfortable with that, but it might be okay. You know, could we stay at your house and sleep in the same bed? You know, and she wasn't real sure about that, but definitely not interested in supporting any sort of marriage or, you know, gay marriage. That was
right.
Very clear.
Okay.
So, there, you know, but... she's made some progress actually since that conversation, but it was a huge moment for me to just get, I mean, again, it was so much more rewarding to do that than talking to any church leader or bringing anyone to the gospel. All these things that I thought in the past were going to really bring me that, you know, redemption. This felt way better than that. So,
okay.
We had this sort of moment. It was horrible, but we got through it. And I joined a lesbian choir in Portland. It was terrifying. Mm-hmm. And this is where you get my it gets better story, right?
Uh-huh.
So I join this lesbian choir, and I show up to the rehearsal, and I think it's going to be all those, like, kind of alternative people and witchy people. And they did have a lot of people like that. Mm-hmm. But then they had some normal-looking people, you know? And I was like, wow, you mean lesbians can be normal-looking? That's so cool. I'm getting laughed at over here. And that's where, you know, Sunshine and I met, was in this choir, and we were became really good friends. And which, long story short, developed into a wonderfully healthy, loving relationship.
Mm-hmm.
We just got our domestic partnership a few months ago, and we're about to have a little celebration party.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. And our relationship is so healthy. We're like, we're just not going to question that. We don't, mm-hmm. It feels really good. But, and she has a daughter, and you know, what's really beautiful about that is, back when I was on my mission, I had this feeling at the end of the mission. I was like, oh, I, you know, really enjoyed my mission. And what was I going to do in my life to really keep this spirit with, you know, with me? And my answer at that time was to have a family. And I thought, okay. And I'm thinking in the Mormon context, well, yes, of course, that's the perfect Mormon answer.
Right.
But it just never really, like, jived for me. I never understood that. I never could, like, connect with guys in a way that I'd want to, you know, have a family with them. And I just feel like now that I have this family, it totally feels that way. It feels like this is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is where it all led me to this, if that makes sense.
Right. Right. It all, the situation that you thought would bring you that peace and that feeling that you wanted to keep going actually did happen, just not the way you thought it would happen.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
When you joined the choir, was at that point, did you just leave the church behind? How did that all play out?
Well, it was really kind of like the first couple of weeks I was going to the Portland Lesbian Choir, I was sort of on the fence because I'd been in the Portland Mormon Choir mm-hmm. the year before that. So it was really, I didn't tell any of my lesbian friends that, you know, you don't want to tell lesbians you're a Mormon and you don't want to tell Mormons you're a lesbian. You know, it's really bad. You get it on both sides, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just, for a while I was like, well, I didn't really feel like, I don't know, like completely leaving my belief in the church. I thought maybe I could just be gay and still kind of believe it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, joining the choir and making friends there and spending a lot of time with those friends, it became really clear to me that that was a ridiculous idea to try to hold on to that.
And so you just
too much dissonance. It's like they contradict each other. And I realized my truth was that I'm a lesbian and not that, you know, the church is true.
Right. And you're not going to put any qualifiers on being a lesbian.
Right. Exactly. Right. I just knew if I was going to do it, I was going to do it all the way.
Okay. And so at that point, did you think maybe the church is true and I'm just going to have to suffer the consequences of the way I live my life? Or at that point, had you decided it's hokum?
Well, I guess at that point, I was still kind of, maybe it's true, or maybe there's things about it that were true, but that, you know, aspiring to be in the highest level of the celestial kingdom wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I could choose to not live like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of started out like that, but then it's kind of moved into, and actually I'm really still processing a lot of this, but I've kind of moved into more of a spiritual plane where I don't believe in the Mormon church. I do believe there's some goodness that comes from it, but I believe there's not goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at it like I always tell people, to me, it's like Walmart. You know, it's like an organization. It has no soul, you know. And so I shouldn't look towards the church. The church isn't going to like snuggle me at night when I come home from work with a bad day, you know.
Right. Like
the church isn't going to be a partner to me in my life, you know. Mm-hmm. The church is just the church. And so I think there's sort of a... I did a complete separation from the church and my spiritual life.
Okay.
And the more I've separated that, the less, I mean, I really don't believe in a lot of the uniquely Mormon doctrine, but I do believe in God. Mm-hmm. And I still believe, but I don't believe that we have a need for a savior and an atonement. I don't believe we need that. I believe that we as humans are perfect right now.
Okay.
And, you know, and now I've actually been going to a different church called the Center of Spiritual Living. And mm-hmm. it's like science of mind kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's kind of woo woo, but it's cool. They read from, what's the book they read from? The, Ernest Holmes, Science of Mind. That's it.
Okay.
But it really, what I like about this is it puts into context all those spiritual experiences I had, right?
Right.
So like that moment I had at 14 when I prayed and really felt that, and that really like, it almost became unhealthy because it really kept me going to church because I would always draw back from these experiences like, well, I can't deny that I felt the spirit, so it must, you know, be true. And, you know, it can't just be in my head. Whereas what I'm learning now is it can be just in my head. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And that's actually kind of amazing that my head, my mind can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, that my mind can give me answers. Mm-hmm. You know, okay. It's kind of cool to think like that. It's very empowering.
So what got you started listening to podcasts, the Mormon podcasts?
I think I got into it because of that listserv I was on. Somebody posted an interview that I don't know, that John, somebody did, and I just got hooked. I was like, oh, this is interesting. Yeah, like they're talking about things that I wish I could talk about, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but I can't really talk to my lesbian friends about this, you know,
okay,
and I can't really talk to my Mormon friends about this. So it was very satisfying in that way, you know.
Mm-hmm. All right, so everything's good now?
My life is perfect, and I have no problems. I think one thing, and I don't really have an answer for this, but I don't really know how to correct ideas from the nieces and nephews. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, my niece said something disturbing the other day about, you know, two girls can't get married. The church says that's wrong. And I'm like, oh, boy.
Right.
And so things like that, I don't really know how to, like, counteract that, you know. And especially when I put myself in a position of I don't go to church, you mm-hmm. know. So I lose a little credibility to kind of correct those ideas.
Right, because they automatically brush whatever you have to say off as, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Like, I'm now in the sort of non-member category. You know how in yeah. your life you have your friends that are in the church and out of the church.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have different kind of conversations with both.
Right. So would the parent of that niece be upset if you did try to persuade her?
Well, fortunately for this particular niece, no. She's super supportive of me. Mm-hmm. But I've had comments from other siblings that are like, or I get a lot of the... we support you even though we don't agree with your life.
Right.
And part of me is like, okay, I mean, that's the best you can do, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to complain because a lot of people don't even have that. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of, what would real support look like to me? You know, wouldn't be that you tolerate me, but that you like really look at mine and Sunshine and our family as equal to all of the other, you know, 15 families.
Right. You know? Right.
like, there's no difference. And it's hard. Like, we're doing this celebration in a couple of weeks. And, you know, my mom is too busy. She's going to my nephew's ordination, you know, as opposed to. And I'm thinking, if I was marrying a guy, do you think she'd miss that?
No. Yeah. So you're in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And I
I'm in Portland now.
Yeah. Oh, you are in Portland. Mm-hmm. Well, shucks. I was thinking, I just heard on the news that Christine Gregoire thinks that they'll legalize marriage there in Washington.
Yeah, we thought maybe we'd move back over the bridge. But we know we just bought a beautiful house. So Portland. I don't think we're going anywhere in a long time.
Well, I doubt Oregon will be far behind.
Portland's pretty good. I mean, we have domestic partnership, which gives us all the legal rights mm-hmm. as being married. So what we're calling our party is it's an everything but married party. Because we don't, you know, we can't be married. That would be wrong. So we're everything but married.
Right. Right.
And I like to make sure I make that distinction because I don't want to call, and I know a lot of gay couples will call their, you know, spouse and a wife or a husband. And I just feel like, I don't think that really helps our cause. I think we need to call it what it is, you know, because then if we pretend like we're married, then what's the point of getting married? Does that make sense?
Okay. So I at first thought you meant that you didn't want to call Sunshine your wife because you didn't want to further make straight, you know, people who are against gay marriage even more outraged. But it's more that if gay marriage means something, then you shouldn't be taking on those labels until you actually have it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's more what I feel. Besides, we don't like the word wife. It just sounds so, like, patriarchal.
How about spouse? Does spouse work for you?
The spouse? I don't know. Do you like spouse? No. It's okay. It's spouse is okay. Partner is nice. I like to say I wear one part pant leg and she wears the other pant leg.
Okay. All right. Well,
but yeah. So yeah, no, we're just trying to be where we are, you know, and if we can get married one day, then we can be wives.
You can be sister wives.
I've always wanted to be a sister wife. I think there was a lot of hanky panky going on back then with those sister wives.
That might have been the case.
Don't try to convince me otherwise. There's a reason they put up with that polygamy stuff.
Right.
You know, it means a lot to me to be able to share my story because I got to tell you, Heather, I don't know, for like 10 years, I didn't say boo about this to anyone.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And it's just really remarkable that I can share this so freely with you and a public audience. You know, it's really like you don't really know how far I've come. You know?
So it's more than just sharing your story for the podcast. It's like a symbol of how much your life has improved and changed.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there is the, if I can help someone else on their journey, that would mean a lot to me, you know, but yeah, it is sort of a good checkpoint for me to kind of go, wow, you know, look at me, mm-hmm. look at me. If I can do it, so can you.
Yeah.
But it's just hard because you want to reach out to these poor Mormon youth, you know. I mean, I know this guy in my old ward who was, I think he was struggling with, like, transgender stuff. And I mm-hmm. thought, oh. But how do you talk to him about it? You know, you can't just say, I heard about this.
You know? Right.
Because they're probably mortified and embarrassed and going through all the things. I didn't want to talk to. If somebody would have confronted me, I would have died.
Right.
Probably denied it.
Yeah.
So it's so hard because, like, how do you reach these people without, you know, at their pace? I don't know.
Well, putting things out there on the internet that they can listen to when they, you know, get the gumption up to do it, I guess.
Yeah, that helped me. The internet was huge.
Yeah.
I'd be in my bedroom at night, napping secretly. I didn't look at porn. I was looking at, like, affirmation websites. Oh boy.
Hopefully all this won't be necessary at some point in the future. And
yeah, you know, really, really, really. But I do have a great sense of humor still about the church. I love making fun of church culture. And mm-hmm. So this, the Facebook side and the podcast have been great for me in that way.
Good. I'm glad. Thank you so much for sending me an email and asking to come on. I think this is going to be a great episode. And
thank you. Well, right. Thank you for the work you're doing. And yeah, if I can help, let me know.
Definitely. All right, everybody, you know the routine. The conversation will continue at mormonexpression.com/voices.
And letting go has not been easy, but I don't need you loving me for who you think I should be. No, I'm standing here at the end of who I once was, not sure yet. Better.